the new revolution in radio.
CyberStationUSA.com.
Americans are united in sending one message.
Good will to the people of this land.
I will do my best to represent my nation.
We have a picture now. Really looks good.
This is the evolution of radio.
We are more integrated now than at any other point in the history of the human race.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
This is CyberStation USA, America's unique online experience.
Hi, this is Fred Taylor from Scholars Jazz Club in Boston, inviting you to join me in the Jazz Room with host Joan Watson-Jones. That's Wednesdays at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time on the CyberStationUSA.com radio network.
Hello, welcome to the Jazz Room. I'm your host, Joan Watson-Jones. Thanks for stopping by. Come in, relax, and enjoy great jazz. Each week we present the music of independent jazz artists, as well as those we've grown to love through the years. And yes, of course, the legends. Our guest today is Boston's jazz hero, Fred Taylor. He has helped many artists who are now legends themselves, from Dave Brubeck to Billy Joel, get their start in the music business, also giving them a hand along the way. We open with a little bit of Dizzy Gillespie and his famous tune, Salt Peanuts. Fred will tell us how this piece of music started him in his long career of representing jazz talent. Enjoy. Welcome to the Jazz Room, Fred Taylor.
Hi, well, nice to be here.
Oh, we are visiting you in your office in Boston. No, Alston, Mass.
In Alston, yeah. Which is part of Boston.
Which is part of Boston,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so this has been a nice treat. This is a nice treat. Thank you so much. Now, you've been in the business for how long?
Well, I officially started in the music business in 1960. Why I say officially, because I was sort of hobbying around from 1950 for about 10 years. Besides going out and getting hooked on jazz with the first record, by the way, I ever bought was Dizzy Gillespie's Salt Peanuts. And that hooked me. That just hit me. I loved everything about it. I loved not only the music and his, but the humor of Dizzy as well. So, and then I got into tape recorders in the, just around 1950 they started coming up, and which is another story, but it led to my recording Dave Brubeck and became a very famous recording. But that was all during my hobby years when I was working for Serta Mattress.
Oh. You were working for Serta Mattress. Okay. Okay.
I worked for Serta Mattress in days I was out clubbing at all the Boston hotspots in the 50s, the jazz clubs.
Okay. Before I go into the Boston hotspots, did you ever play any musical instruments?
I studied piano with Margaret Chaloff, who was a very famous lady, when I was 11 years old, and it was classical piano. One of her sons, by the way, was Serge Chaloff, the great baritone sax player from the Woody Herman Four Brothers Band. But I never really continued it when I was, I think, in my late teens or early 20s, I did take a little popular piano from a pianist named Sid Reinhertz, who used to be WORL was a famous station back in the day, the 920 Club. And Sid Reinhertz did this program, I don't know whether it was once a week or every five times a week. It was a, I think it was a 15-minute show where at the Stark Piano Warehouse, and he would play on a different piano. It was a promotion for the Stark Piano, but playing on, and now I'm playing on a 6-foot bomb or whatever. But anyways, he also was a teacher, and he was incredible. I would come in, he would write out an arrangement for me with the melody line and the chords. And that's, I would have to practice that and come back and play it. I still have those music sheets in my apartment. There was a Don't Get Around Much Anymore, I think was one of them. Exactly Like You. I remember there was, I have about four or five great range, and it was sort of slightly stride piano style. But I didn't continue. I wanted to be Oscar Peterson in 20 minutes, and I just, you know, couldn't get there. I did play a little trumpet at one point, but again, you have to keep your lip up and play every day, and it just wasn't in the cards for me. And the last thing I ended up was, and I still do for fun, I play a little bit of, it's a cocktail drum I have. We play it with brushes, and I led a band in my BU years playing that. I was a good timekeeper, not a star drummer, just a good timekeeper. So there's a little preview.
Wow. Well, that's really cool, because I'm not sure too many people know all this stuff.
By the way, it'll be in a book. I heard getting about close that. To finishing it. I'm working with Richard Vacca, who has a wonderful book out on the market right now called The Boston Jazz Chronicles from 1935 to 62. And it's an amazing book. He has done research. Oh, my God. He's got things in there that, I mean, I lived through some of that period, and I didn't quite remember them, but then reading the book, I said, oh, my, yeah, right, oh, boy. So he's my co-writer on this book, so he's wonderful to work with.
Oh, well, that sounds like something to look forward to.
By the way, I'll give you the title. What, and Give Up Showbiz? Right, that says it all.
That says it all. A lot of us might say that. Now, in your pre-music business years, in the pre-jazz years,
yes,
we're going to go back about that recording that you made with Dave Brubeck.
There'll be a great in the book. I tell that story, which was, the band that I kind of fronted when I was at BU, the pianist in the band was named Creighton Hoyt. And Creighton used to tell me when he was in the service, there was a pianist in his regiment who was fantastic. And he was known out in the West Coast, but if he ever came east, I should catch him. Well, one day, it was, I think it was 1951, I looked at the newspaper, the ads with all the coming attractions for the clubs, and I see Storyville, Dave Brubeck. Dave Brubeck, that's the guy Creighton's been telling me about. Geez, I gotta go down and catch it. So I went down on a Sunday afternoon with my little tape recorder and one microphone, and I said, hey, Dave, I'm Fred Taylor, and my pianist in my group, Creighton, has told me all about you. He said, Creighton Hoyt, he saved my life in the Army. I said, oh, I didn't know it was that much. He said, yeah, whatever you want to do, go ahead. So it was Paul Desmond and Dave and just the drummer, the bass player, that's Matinee Sunday. For some reason, he wasn't there. So I kind of fished around to find the perfect spot for my one microphone. And we recorded, and at the end he said, gee, I'd like to hear what you got. So I said, well, this is just a tape deck. I have to plug it into a whole, you know, system in order to hear it. He says, well, anywhere we could do it. I said, well, yeah, at my home. So Paul and Dave piled into my car. I drove them. I was still living with my folks in Newton. And I plugged it into the set, and he said, "Wow, that's great. I've never been caught playing quite like that," because he played differently for the lack of the bass player. And he said, "You know, could you get me a copy of that?" I said, "Yeah, I can go to a studio Monday and have a dupe made." So he gave me, he said, "I'll be in New York for the week. Here's the address and everything." So I sent it to him. I think it was Thursday of that week I get a call. He said, "My company wants to put this out." I said, "Whoa, yeah, okay. Gee." So I sold the that tape for $150. Whoa, it paid for my whole tape recorder and microphone. Wowee, wow-a-rama. Oh, boy. Well, anyways, that turned out to be one of the great recordings. It came out on a 10-inch LP. LPs were just coming out at that time. The extended play was brand new, and so the first iteration were in 10-inch LPs, and then they went, about a year or so later, they went to the 12-inch size. Well, that record got picked up in the New York Times, first by John Wilson, who was writing about a whole lot of things. Columbia, just a new 18-channel studio, Bob Isaac. However, the most impressive new recording of the year, done on amateur equipment with one microphone, achieving natural balance, was Paul Desmond at Storyville. Then a few months later, John Hammond, in an article in the New York Times, wrote, "Although the LP format has been out for a while, most artists are still recording 3-minute cuts, except for the extraordinary live recording of Dave Brubeck, Paul Desmond at Storyville with a 7-minute cut of Over the Rainbow." Well, that record created so much buzz, Columbia Records ended up signing him. So, a little prelude after that. Storyville, 1951, moved to the from Kenmore Square, the Buckminster, to the Copley Square Hotel downtown. And Dave came in a year later to play, and the Columbia had put one album out in the interim. And when he came in, he called me and said, "Would you mind coming down and record some more?" So I said, "Okay." Well, so he said, "You know, give me the tapes, because if they think they came from an amateur recorder, they'll just throw them out. I'll just hand them and say, 'Look, these are some tapes that were done.'" His next album that came out on Columbia, it looked like a newspaper cover. Two of the cuts, "Don't Worry About Me" and "On the Alamo," were from those tapes.
All right.
So be it.
Yeah, so be it. So be it. Now tell me about Storyville. You were talking about Storyville, because I didn't grow up in Boston, so I never got to know the clubs in Boston. So if you could sort of take me on a tour of what it was like in Boston, what the clubs were. Start with Storyville, because I know that's where you recorded the Dave Brubeck.
Well, Storyville actually was, on the scene around 90, I think George opened, George Ween, that was his club, and he opened that. The Buckminster Hotel is right in Kenmore Square. It's like on the triangle of Brookline Avenue and Beacon Street, and it was a downstairs location, and I think it was in 49 that George opened that, and he started having, just all the great artists were coming in. But in Boston, going back, the 40s and 50s, Mass Avenue and Columbus Avenue were, it was like New York's 52nd Street. There was the Hi-Hat, Wally's Paradise, the Savoy, the Big M, Estelle's, the Pioneer Club, Club Eddie's, all in that little cluster. And then if you went down a couple blocks to Washington Street, there was Basin Street South and Big Jim Mellon's, and there was the 411. And in Copley Square, there was this Beacon Chambers. And the original jazz workshop was in a bar on Huntington Avenue. It was called The Stables. And you went in, it was a bar, and then at the end of the room, there was like a little door and a ramp that went down. And that's where Herb Pomeroy and Vardy Haritunian and Ray Santisi started the very first jazz workshop. And what happened is, years later, through a connection I had made with this gentleman, Harold Buckhalter, who owned the Stables and many other places, he had to move his club because the state was coming through with that, Route 95, the expressway, so he had to move all his businesses, and he told me he was going to open up a brand new jazz workshop on Boylston Street. So that's when it moved. That was in 1963 that move occurred, and that's when I started my relationship in the jazz workshop, and then Paul's Mall a year later, and ended up owning both of those clubs with my partner, Tony Moriello.
Oh, okay. So that's very, thank you. Because I've always wondered how everything fell together and what have you through the years. Because I always hear from other jazz musicians, they tell me about Boston.
And by the way, and I helped start Lenny's on the Turnpike, which was... because of my, I'll go back to that 1960 date for a minute. Because I was kind of known to be running around with my recorder, a friend of mine, John Stukas, who worked for George in Storyville and helped him with promotion, called me one day. He says, "Hey, I found this incredible jazz organist, and he's playing at this Jackie's Game Bar in Lynn, and would you come out and record him?" So I said, "Yeah, okay." So I went out, and that was Joe Bucci and Joe Riddick on drums. Joe Bucci on the Hammond B3 with, he had a special, what they call a Kruger bass attachment on the pedals, which gave it the sound of a string bass as opposed to the normal Hammond flat, blah, blah, blah. And his left foot was the third man that wasn't there. That's what we used to call it. And so I recorded that for about four nights. And at the end of it, John, what are you going to do? Well, I don't know. I said, you know, this guy's fabulous. So he and I teamed up. We said, let's see if we can promote him. I had left Serta. I forgot to look for work and got busy trying to promote. And that's the beginning of my official music career.
Wow, interesting, because Joe Bucci was on my list to ask you about, because I met Joe Bucci back in the middle 90s.
Yeah.
Pianist named Tony Zano introduced me to Joe. He and Joe were good friends, and he was a guest on my first television show. And I got to know Joe. I got to know his wife. I knew his son who played drums.
Yeah.
And because they all lived up in New Hampshire.
Right.
And Joe told me all his story, and I learned all of Joe's story. Now I have the other half.
Right. We have, I tell you, I signed him to Capitol Records, and we did a fabulous LP called Wild About Basie.
I have that.
And it is still one of the great.
It is. It is.
Great.
And... Oh, I'm having one of those moments.
Yes.
I was going to ask
Take two moments.
Take two moments. Now, were you instrumental in having him be the opener for Count Basie and all that?
Oh, well, that's how we... John knew, my partner, John Stukas, knew some guys in the Basie band, and he got a message that they were coming through to go to play some dates up in the New Hampshire ballrooms. So we said, geez, we could do a date and put Joe on as an opening act. So we did this. It was the Starlight Ballroom in Linfield. And we did a big promotion all together. And it was in, I think it was in August. There had been a drought for about a month and a half. And came the Saturday of the show, it started to rain. And boy, did it start to rain. The Starlight Ballroom was Starlight. No roof, just the opening, the shed shell for the band. So we had a scrambled around, and we got the Lynn, the Aganis Auditorium in Lynn, and we were able to move the concert in there somehow, and we got on the radio and told everybody. Well, anyways, Basie loved Joe, and as a result, he said, how would you like to come down and play my club in New York? So we all went down and played Basie's, which was, I think, 151st Street in Harlem, and played a week there. It was fabulous, just fabulous. And then eventually we signed him to Capitol, and we kept working with Joe, and we got him in the Newport Jazz Festival, and I'll tell you, to this day, I believe he was probably the most competent Hammond B3 in the use of that organ. He would pull stop. Matter of fact, Hammond came out a few years after we were working with him. Hammond came out with another small little Hammond they call the Extra Voice, which had a whole lot of different sounds. He had the engineers at Hammond marry that into his B3 as a third manual, so that he then was able to solo with all kinds of different guitar, baritone, sax. You watch Joe, it looked like he was playing handball, because his hands would be flying up, pulling the stops, changing up the sounds. And he really made more use of a Hammond than any organist I have ever seen. He was a master of using that instrument. Yeah, he was great.
Yeah. So, okay. Now, you were booking. Now, did you book Storyville?
No.
Now, when you started booking rooms, I know you booked a lot of famous people. Any stories of anyone you want to start telling me about?
Well,
tell us about some of the...
What happened is, as we were working with Joe, we started to get calls from some artists saying, hey, do you think you might be able to book us? So we started a little agency for booking, and I remember bringing Howard McGhee. He had just kind of come out of rehabs and was clean, and we booked him into a little place on Conrad Tremont and Boylston Street. It used to be this bar. And then Herbie Mann, I remember booking him down at a club in New Bedford. I think it was called, not the Majestic, the Embassy. I think it was something like the Embassy. It doesn't exist anymore. And we were doing, and then there was a guy that used to hang around our office waiting for it to get a gig named James Taylor. Yeah. There's a lot of the folkies that we were working with early on. Mm-hmm. What really took hold is when I came into working on the Jazz Workshop. And from that point on, the Jazz Workshop in Paul's Mall, 1963 through 78, is the most incredible history of music, almost. we started so many of the, I mean, we opened with Herb Pomeroy's band, which was Ray Santisi on piano, John Neves on bass, Pete LaRocca on drums, and special guest Stan Getz. And then from there on, we saw Sonny Stitt and John Coltrane, and I mean, just the entire history of music is in the Jazz Workshop. And then I started working with Miles Davis in 1967 and worked with Miles basically till the day he died. We also did the very famous return of Miles Davis in 1981. He had disappeared for about 5 years, and I got a call from him. He said, I'm going to be recording again. I'm going to be doing a big New York debut, but I need a warm-up. Will you get me a date in Boston? So our clubs had already been closed, but I found a great little place called Kicks, which on Commonwealth Avenue, which was a disco up front, but there was a great club that they weren't using behind it, and I made a deal with a guy to take that over. And that's where we presented in 1981, The Return of Miles Davis. And there's a recording live at Kicks. That was monumental. Press from all over the world came. I remember we opened on a Thursday night. Japan, London, France, you name it. It was the most incredible run. So, and then on the Paul's Mall side, we opened with Henny Youngman, followed by Professor Irwin Corey, and then. So I was doing everything in Paul's Mall. Comedians, we introduced Earth, Wind and Fire, Aerosmith, Seals and Croft, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel. I mean, those were all the incubators. The Paul's Mall years. And the workshop, it was something, these are all in the 60s, 70s. There was something about those years and those performances with the artists that have lingered on. And Billy Joel, who did Fenway Park a few months ago, the first words out of his mouth, "I love Boston. I got my start at a little club called Paul's Mall." 40 years later, it still was so meaningful to them, the startups, and that Earth, Wind, and Fire, the same thing comes out of them. Bruce Springsteen still talks about his startup. It really was, those were amazing years.
This ends part one of our interview with Fred Taylor. Learn more about Fred at www.scullersjazz.com. The music you heard in this program were Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond, Over the Rainbow from the recording Jazz at Storyville, Dave Brubeck on the Alamo from the recording Dave Brubeck at Storyville, Joe Bucci from his recording Wild About Basie, three tunes, Blue and Sentimental, Shiny Stockings, and Jumpin' at the Woodside. Right now you're listening to Moton Swing, featuring Herb Pomeroy's Jazz Workshop Quintet. Next week, Fred will talk about his friendship with Miles Davis and Roy Haynes. Thank you for spending time here with us in the Jazz Room. We love hearing from you. You can now find the Jazz Room on Twitter, #@MsJazzKitty, Or you may email me through the Jazz Room page of my website, JoanWatsonJones.com. Until next time, you've been in the Jazz Room. I'm your host, Joan Watson Jones.
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
There is a man behind the curtain. This isn't the Wizard of Oz. The shake-up to the music business machine.
That sounds fun!
This is a far more deadly predator than anyone ever imagined.
Perfectly designed.
I wonder which came first.
CyberStation USA.
CyberStation USA is the future of radio. Get your business into the online future at the world's largest internet radio station. From banner placement on our homepage to any of our broadcaster stages, commercials on our video player, audio spots on any of our shows, or at the beginning of any of our on-demand broadcasts. CyberStation USA offers competitive rates with a worldwide reach, a fully integrated one-stop-shop social media broadcast platform. For more information, please contact our sales department at cameo@cyberstationusa.com.
Cameo Entertainment Group and CyberStation USA are now part of Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. With Stitcher, you can listen to live programming as well as archive radio programming right on your phone. To obtain Stitcher, just go to the App Store for your particular phone. Go to search, then type in Stitcher. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
Then download. It's that simple. Stitcher, a free radio app for your smartphone. Convenient access to live and archive CyberStation USA programming on your mobile phone. That's Stitcher. S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.
CyberStation USA, always on the go.
Every so often you have technology come along that rewrite the rules of the game.
Digital culture isn't characterized by the home computer.
You speak instantly to a man standing on the shore of France.
The CyberStation, the USA, the .com.
Worldwide. Everything has changed.
A new age.
The biggest ride in all of history.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Worldwide.
This is the future.
The future.
Radio.
The future.
The future.
The future of radio.
And that really is the message.